Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Coming up on this week's show, two gaming giants unite for a new console,
an amazing new N64 platformer,
and we chat to ScumVM project lead Eugene Sandilenko.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every Friday with our amazing sponsor, our friends at Bitmap Books. Now, if you love the topic of today's podcast, one of my favourite books they've ever done, that actually is getting a reprint a bit later on this year in the summer, The Art of Point-and-Click Adventure Games. Now, this is a sumptuous 528-page hardback coffee table book with the best pixel art and classic scenes from some of the biggest video games, and featuring more than 50 exclusive interviews with the biggest players in that genre. You can check it out and the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. And with our friends at PCBWay. Now, I'm sure you know about PCBWay. If you're in the market for a fully featured custom PCB prototyping service, they've got you covered. Low-cost, fast-turnaround quality boards, and they offer services like 3D printing and injection molding. And, of course, they're massive supporters of the retro community. So get an instant quote right now at PCBWay.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 463, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And a very warm welcome to the podcast, a show that every single Friday, of course, celebrates all the wonderfulness about the world of retro gaming. The golden age of video games, taking you back to the 80s, 90s, noughties, sometimes the 70s. Celebrating everything that's going on in the world of retro, and of course, bringing you up to speed on all the big happenings in the world of retro gaming and technology from over the last 7 days. And continuing into 2025, bringing you industry veterans and legends onto the podcast every single Friday for a chat. And I know it has been a pretty rough start to the year for many people. I did see some awful footage of the fires in LA over the last week or so. And I know we do have some listeners in that part of the world, so fingers crossed you've got out safely and you and your family are all okay. Seen some horrific video footage from that area. And actually over here, it's been quite the opposite, hasn't it? It's been minus temperatures and floods as well around here.
And we had quite a bad flood at the Retro Computer Museum in Leicester. And, yeah, you know, these guys are good friends of ours. We've gone over quite a few times, and it's a proper wicked place. You know, it's like a community-driven space as well. They have a lot of community volunteers and lots of friends that kind of have come along and helped out, because they've moved a lot of the museum up to the top floor, luckily. So there wasn't that much damage that there could have been. You know, there could have been devastation, and
they were worried like 20 years worth of work would be down the drain.
They've got like a whole video game library, which is just amazing, and you know, if that got damaged, it'd be absolutely tragic. But luckily people have rallied around and you know, helped support them as well. But I even heard on my local news that they were talking about the place, and it's been really bad with some of the weather and some of the floods.
Yeah, but luckily they should be back on the feet soon. I think they're planning on reopening on the 25th of January. And of course, people have been donating to help them out. So if you want to support them, I'll put a link in this week's show notes. And if you want to go and visit them as well, we were saying before the podcast, we're long overdue a visit. I think Joe is due his first ever visit, outrageously.
Yeah, calling me out there, man. I've never been. So let's make a point of the three of us all going in the next couple of months. And if there's anybody about at the time, we'll announce it. I say we'll announce it. Yeah. We'll mention it on the podcast. Like, well, we're going down that weekend. If anybody's about, it'd be great to see people. But yeah, I really need to get my ass there.
Yeah, they've got an arcade section there as well. And I think that may have been the one that actually got, you know, hit by the floods, because it's on the bottom floor. Hopefully not that much damage, because they've also got those, you know, virtuality Amiga machines as well, which are really rare.
Oh, I remember that. You and me playing that at Play Expo in Blackpool when they brought them over there. I think I felt sick for about 2 hours after I'd been on it.
Yeah, I've been on it many times. Yeah. Not as bad as the Master System stereoscopic 3D. Just sent me into another dimension.
We'll get you on both of them. And this week on the podcast, then, before we get into the news stories that have been making the headlines over the last week, we've got an amazing guest on this week's show. You and I did this one, Ravi, and, you know, we had to be in the resident point-and-click adventure game fans on the show. We're talking to Eugene Sandwalenko, who actually is behind, he's the project lead of the Scum VM.
Yeah, it's a Scum VM is just insane. It was a script utility from Maniac Mansion, wasn't it?
That's what Scum stood for, yeah.
And this is the virtual machine. And this is basically an amazing piece of software. If you've not heard of it in the retro world, then where have you been?
It's on everything, isn't it?
It's on everything, yeah. It's like, I've seen ports of it on like the PSP and, you know, all sorts of devices. The Ouya was one that we were talking about as well.
It's on the Amiga, it's on BOS, it's on the PlayStation, the GameCube, the Wii, all sorts.
And it supports so many games and kind of adventure games as well, not just point and click. It started with point and click titles. And oh my God, there's some amazing stuff. Like for me, I'd never heard Monkey Island on the MT32, the Roland, and hearing that soundtrack kind of come through my machine in this environment, it's amazing. And it's not an emulator, is it? It's a bit more than that.
Yeah, it's actually basically a game engine recreation, isn't it? And a lot of them, actually, we talked to Eugene in this interview, it supports over 100 different game engines now, which, is insane. Because, I mean, I knew that it did the LucasArts games, and I knew they expanded to Sierra and Revolution Software and Adventure Soft, but there's even stuff like Macromedia Shockwave supported as well.
Like some of the FMV ones as well, like Seventh Guest and stuff like that. And even Encarta, Microsoft Encarta.
Yeah, which blew my mind that you can run Encarta on it. Yeah. So a really interesting chat about, obviously, because they do a lot for software preservation, don't they? And we do talk in the interview about the fact that, you know, LucasArts actually sent them a cease and desist when they first started back in 2001. But now actually they work with a lot of the people who made the original games, a lot of people in the industry to basically get these titles up and running again on new hardware. So
It's all like done in its spare time as well.
Yeah.
You know, people are contributing to this and there's like experts in the games. But also if you think how many different systems had different versions of the games and what they kind of have to cover and the technical skill behind it, it's a massive achievement, and we see how many legal issues there are with, you know, preservation and getting games out there. So totally applaud it. I personally think they've helped increase the awareness of point-and-click games and, you know, brought them back into people's minds again.
And I love it as well because, I mean, you're the same, Ravi. You and I, you know, we're fans of alternative operating systems. We've both got a MorphOS machine, which is kind of like a PowerPC Amiga spin-off. I've got a Haiku box as well. And one of the first things I always install on like these kind of niche operating systems is Scum VM, because you can guarantee there'll always be a port of it on every little weird platform. And then you get the game library. Basically, you've got like a game library of like hundreds, if not thousands of games ready to run on like the most niche of platforms, which I think is incredible. So I've been a huge fan of the Scum VM project for the last 20 years or so. And we'll hear more about that. And also the ambitions of the team as well and where they want to go next with the project lead, Eugene Sandwalenko. He's coming up on the podcast in around half an hour from now. But of course, before we get into the interview section of the show, we're going to have a little natter about what's been happening in the wonderful world of retro gaming and technology from over the last 7 days. And obviously CES is in full swing at the time we're recording this. A lot of people have been talking about the little glimpses and the rumours that are doing the rounds about the Nintendo Switch 2, of which I have seen a few kind of what claim to be leaked animations and pictures, whether they are or not, time will tell. But actually it seems like in terms of gaming at CES, it is the year of the handheld.
Definitely seems that way. And my arcade in particular have been extremely busy, it feels like, this last couple of years with lots of these kind of retro consoles and handhelds. But this one caught my eye because of there's that many kind of like, handheld retro consoles out there at the moment. It's difficult for us to keep up with them all and talk about every single one every single week, because it does feel like they come out all the time.
Yeah.
But obviously, like you say, there's a lot of hype about the Switch 2. A lad at work today said that the trailer's dropping for it on the 17th of January. And I was like, that's what everybody keeps saying about GTA 6 as well, but we'll see.
But the reason I imagine if it's the same day.
Yeah, can you imagine? Yeah. So, but the reason this one has kind of caught my eye is this is the... I don't know if this has been done before. It probably has been done before, but I've never seen anything like this. But Capcom and Bandai Namco are joining forces for this this massive handheld. It's rather large handheld, which is going to be coming from My Arcade. So it's the Bandai Namco Capcom My Arcade handheld. And what's really interesting about that is obviously Namco and Capcom back in the 80s and 90s were, you know, huge, huge, huge arcade developers, and then Nintendo and Sega and stuff like that. And were always, in my eyes, as like enemies, you know, very big competitors, huge third-party developers for the consoles, and then obviously in the arcades with Street Fighter and Contra and stuff like that. But these are going to be featured on, both of them are going to be featured on this handheld, which the handheld itself isn't massively impressive. It is huge, as I say. It's going to have an 8-inch screen, but it's going to have over 100 games already on there, from Street Fighter, Pac-Man, Galaga, Mega Man, Final Fight 1942, just to name a few, which will vary from arcade ports and home console games, which is quite interesting. And it looks, obviously, from a build quality wise, it looks quite nice from what I can see. You know, you've got your four face buttons, A, B, X, Y, as well as that, your shoulder buttons. You do get a D-pad and an analog stick by the looks of things. And then also four buttons would say M1 and M2 on there. Not 100% sure what they are, but they're below the kind of like the, you know, the normal face buttons. I don't know if they're for games which require six buttons, unless the L and R are used for the
which a lot of those fighters did, didn't they?
Yeah, so I'm not too sure if they're for that, or if they stand for mode maybe, or menu or something. But it caught my eye, like I say, mostly because of the Capcom and Namco coming together. And here on the time extension, you know, it says like the two companies don't seem to have any sort of issue with both featuring on the same product. But then it leads me to believe, like, have they been told they're both on the same product by My Arcade, which I'm sure.
Yeah, no, well, they're doing two as well. So they've got the handheld unit, and then they've got the little bar top unit as well.
Yes.
And at the top the bar top, you've got the Bandai Namco and then Capcom. And
both logos are on there.
Yeah, and that's interesting because it's got a dial on it as well. And obviously you've got the six button and joystick, which is an interesting way to play it. I like that dial on the controllers as well. They've got a little My Arcade unit.
And I think, yeah, I mean, I'm looking at the bar top one, to me kind of probably does look my preferred way of playing it. Because if I bought this, it would be for the Capcom fighters.
Yeah.
I think. And again, you know, you've got to play them with a joystick. I think if you're playing the arcade versions, just feel weird on the D-pad.
Were you a fighting stick guy?
Yeah, well, I mean, even on, you know, like Sega Saturn, I've got a fighting stick for. Weirdly, most of my Sega systems, yeah, Dreamcast I've got, and I've got on the Mega Drive as well. Doesn't help me play any better.
It's not what you claim when you're drunk.
My wife can still thrash me on Ready to Rumble on the Dreamcast, even though I forked out about 100 quid for a fighting stick to beat and it didn't work. But yeah, so I think it is very cool. Like you said, Joe, a lot of these are coming out at the moment, but I think it is a nice little collection, particularly, you know, I think I have over 100 titles on here as well, including like all the big ones, Pac-Man, Galaga, even like Pole Position. Street Fighter 2 is going to be on there, 1942. So it does seem quite a varied collection from obviously two gaming giants. So they have been demoing that at CES. If you want to check out the video and the images, I'll put those in this week's show notes. Wasn't the only thing of interest in terms of handhelds on My Arcade stand, though. They're also working with Atari.
Yeah, this is interesting. It's got a weird name, the Game Station Go. And in other countries, it may be like, oh, fine, Game Station. But I remember that as being a store full of like goths. Much like probably the ones that work in CEX now worked in Game Station for a while, and I remember the Pop Station as well, which was one of those kind of sketchy consoles. But this one looks really nice. I think a lot of people have been really interested because it's got the paddle on there as well as a trackball controller, which is awesome to see with some of those arcade titles. It does seem like My Arcade is the kind of place that's, you know, doing all these licensing deals with the companies and kind of pumping it out. You had a good point earlier to me, Dan. You said, is it the same hardware inside?
And, yeah, wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, and I guess same screen. And, you know, they've just swapped the shell around. I just wonder if those extra features on there are going to make it cost a little bit more.
I mean, if they're the same hardware, it wouldn't surprise me if pricing's kind of similar on them both. So like you said, all they've got to do is change the... then again, I imagine it depends on how much they're paying for the licensing of the games
it's
as well.
The licensing, but then also the Atari one does come with the trackball and the dial pad. But then
the keyboard as well, actually.
It's
got like a telephone dialing pad. Like the Jaguar.
I mean, I would say if I had to have a guess, I would say they're going to come in at the same price. But in terms of actual hardware, what you can see, there is more going on the Atari one, more going on. I was about to say something really stupid then, but you could argue that the games are more advanced on the Capcom Namco one.
It doesn't matter, does it?
In terms of the design of it, though, I think, having the... obviously, if you're going to be playing, you know, there are certain games that definitely suit those controls, having, like, the paddle perfect if you're playing Pong,
for example, Atari owns the Intellivision back catalogue now, doesn't it?
So they do. Yeah. Interesting. So that's
two companies coming together again.
Yeah, and you got the trackball in there if you're playing Millipede. There's going to be a load of games included in there, over 200 titles. So if you want to play Atari games or Capcom and Bandai Namco games on the go, good month for you. So if you want to check out more about those two stories, I'll put those in the show notes as well. Now, something that caught your eye, Joe, and I do think this looks really interesting. This is a new platformer that is currently on Kickstarter and inspired, and actually from a bunch of modders who've worked on games like Mario 64. This is called HeroQuest 64.
Yeah, so just to be clear, this isn't on the N64. It will be on the PC and potentially the Switch. But it looks very much at home on the N64. Other than they have managed to get around the Vaseline vision, you know, that draw distance of the N64. Yeah. But yeah, like you say, this comes from a few developers now and has just absolutely smashed it on Kickstarter, and there's a demo available now. But in terms of gameplay, it very much kind of like, for me, resembles Croc meets Mario 64 meets Donkey Kong 64 meets Banjo-Kazooie. So you play as Kiro, who's this little blue frog. You kind of run around very of that, those games I've just mentioned, very colourful, whimsical kind of like landscapes and, you know, quite open world, but obviously level based. But it's very puzzle platformer because it looks as though you have to hop about and use his tongue to climb up things and stuff like that. But like these guys, obviously working on Mario, they've been Mario and Zelda modders for decades.
So Brodoot, who is the level designer, you know, he's kind of been doing level design for over 12 years. So he's got that experience of making a decent level and, you know, that is weird as well, because that kind of 3D platformer niche is a bit different to something like, you know, Crash Bandicoot, where you're kind of playing in a different style. And I can imagine, you know, doing Mario 64, it's kind of you have to make a level really intuitively and like to explore it the way that the game's built. So it's going to be interesting to see what ideas they implement
I think you've nailed it there with the intuitive, like, kind of like style of it, because you don't get many games like this before, like, anymore. And it just feels like they've really, really thought about the mechanics of the level and how it works from what I can see on the trailer. I've not played the demo, and I hope it does come to the Switch as well as a stretch goal, which is still live now. But you really can see those N64 kind of like fundamentals of like Mario 64. And funny enough, you mentioned Crash Bandicoot there as well. And I don't know if you've picked up on this, but you can spin to attack like in Crash Bandicoot.
Yeah, yeah. So, it also reminds me of Croc a bit and Banjo and Kazooie as well. So
I love the fact that he hangs off platforms and ledges with his tongue.
Yeah.
And kind of uses it as like a grappling hook. Some power in that tongue. But yeah, I agree. I think it looks, you know, if you love those kind of late 90s platformers after they'd, you know, perfected the camera and all those annoyances yeah, that affected yeah. the early ones.
Well, imagine if there's like bad camera mode and you could just go back to it and it's just.
You play it like Bubsy 3D.
In a really bad yeah. way. Yeah. Bubsy mode. Yeah.
Yeah. Over 20 levels included. There's obviously gold coins to collect, which is pretty standard in a. Platform games from back in the day. You can even get unlockable costumes for him to wear as well. At the time of recording, there's only a few days left on this. I think actually it ends on Monday, January 20th. So literally you've got this weekend if you want to get in there and back it. They only wanted £16,800 for it. They're nearly on £30,000 at the time of recording this. And they do say... like you said, there's that free demo that you can download to play on PC. But they said if they do reach the target, they will port this to other platforms, including, it's a bit vague, they've just said the Nintendo consoles. So, I mean, yeah, it sounds like, yeah. Switch will be logistical. And that was a £25,000 stretch goal, which have already passed. Yeah. So it looks like this is going to get a Switch port now as well. But that just seems a bit, you know, they said it will, in the future, release on other platforms such as Nintendo consoles. So I'm wondering, yeah. do you think maybe an N64 port could be in the back of their mind?
It could, yeah, actually. I was going to say, oh, maybe it's because the Switch 2 is on the horizon, but yeah, it might be the N64, which would be very cool.
Yeah, it would, absolutely. So if you want to back that, and if you love those late 90s platformers, you got this weekend to do it, so I'll put that in the show notes along with all the rest of the stories. We're going to talk about an Atari prototype that's been found in a really unusual way in just a moment. And also a remake of one of Joe's favourite games. I can tell you're already itching to talk about this. But before we do, can we just take a quick second to welcome a couple of new patron backers who've supported the podcast over the last week. A little reminder that we do have a Patreon and we are going to be doing our first patrons hangout of the year next weekend, Sunday 26th of January at 8 p.m. UK time. They're always a laugh, aren't they? People, for someone who hasn't joined the patrons hangout before, Joe, maybe our new patrons, there were quite a few of the last couple of weeks. What can they expect from their first one?
What can they? Well, so we all get together. Sometimes we have a bit of a drink. Sometimes we have a laugh. Well, we always have a laugh, to be honest. But no, we all get
you
together.
You always have a drink.
On Google Meetups, and we all just... I'm trying not to be too
geek
rude.
Out.
We just geek out. We just it's like going to the pub with your mates. We all just talk about what we've been up to, talk about what tech we've been using recently, what retro tech. It almost always goes off on a tangent and we talk about a different subject other than retro gaming. But it's usually
horror movies, VHS, mobile phones, so many things.
Retro mini computers, discs. Mini discs, vinyl, anything like that. People are welcome to show off their collections, which is always interesting. People often show off things they've purchased recently, which usually results in other people sometimes spending a little bit of money on this kind of stuff.
Normally you.
Yeah, me, sometimes Dan. But really, really good. We talk a lot about modding on there, which is always fun. But yeah, they're absolutely great. We do it for a couple of hours and we just geek out and have a laugh, really, don't we?
Yeah, and the last one we did was before Christmas, so actually I'm really excited for this again. It's been about 6 weeks now. So if you'd like to join us for our first one of 2025, that's coming up next weekend. If you join Patreon now, you will get the link on there. Also, I don't think we mentioned this enough. Someone mentioned this on Discord that they didn't realise it was a custom RSS feed. So basically, if you listen on a normal podcast app, because I know we do have a few listeners on YouTube, but if you listen on like Spotify or Apple Podcasts, we do actually give you a special link. So you can get the patrons version of the podcast that we do every week. Where we chop the adverts out. We do an extra, 10, 15 minutes of news stories every episode just for our patrons. And also we do a bonus podcast every month for our gold members and above called the Retro Hour After Hours. The latest episode of which we kind of talked about our highlights of the last 30 years, which was an interesting one.
Yeah, mine wasn't the Ouya.
No.
Yeah. No, it's really good actually because we talked about like tech and some really kind of basic things that have completely changed our lives that have had huge impacts and we also talked about gaming, some of the impacts in that and some of the huge changes that happened and not all of them were good. It was interesting to kind of get get some, like, maybe this is good, maybe this is bad. And yeah, also talk about kind of what the future holds as well.
Yeah, so that was our top five tech and gaming innovations of the last 30 years on the latest episode of The After Hours. You unlock that, you also get the previous 45 episodes as well. And really, the main reason you're doing it is just to support the podcast and make sure that we can keep bringing it out every single Friday. It covers our running costs, and we hugely appreciate that. And let's welcome in our two latest backers.
Hall of Fame.
Who we got then?
Chris Luffmiller.
And Andrew.
Thank you so much for your support. We really, really appreciate that. And if you'd like to join our wonderful patrons community, all the details to sign up are on the website right now at theretrohour.com. Right then, before we talk about ScumVM with this week's special guest, Eugene Sandwalenko, a couple more news stories just to quickly chat about, including something else, arcade royalty that is coming to the Xbox in 2025. House of the Dead 2 has been announced.
This is definitely going to be a story for me, this one, guys.
Joey's thinking of getting rid of his Xbox because it's flopping, but you're going to keep it now, yeah?
Wow, you say that. You say that. So we had the House of the Dead remake in 2022, and now we're getting this one, obviously. House of the Dead 2 remake in 2025. House of the Dead 1, original. Obviously, very popular game. Number two is like arcade royalty, especially for light gun fans. Like, fantastic game. I'm excited. And usually I do like to be very positive on this podcast, even too positive, some people will say. But I wasn't a big fan of that remake of number one. I found it a bit janky, a bit clunky.
You weren't the only person to say that, though. I remember getting some bad reviews.
I need to go back and play it again because I've heard there's been updates and stuff like that. But I played it when it first came out, and I was trying to play it. I got it for the Switch, and I was playing it with the Joy-Cons in the... what's it called? The mode...
Like motion control. Motion
controls,
yeah.
There we go. I was playing it with the motion controls, and it just... I don't know if it was the Switch motion controls or what, like, but I just was not having a good time trying to play it with the motion controls. And I have... had no issues using the motion controls on like the Mario Party games and stuff like that. So I had to switch it to just, you know, using the cursor on the screen and, you know, use the analog stick to just hover over the enemies and shoot. And I just found the frame rate dropped and stuff like that quite a lot. And I just found the game very like, I mean, I know it's an arcade shooter, like, but I just found it, I played it through like twice and I was just like, well, there's no other modes really. Like there was one other, like time attack mode or something, my memory, I can't remember now, but there was no kind of like, there wasn't much substance there, you know, like I know it wasn't like a £50 game, it was like £25 or something like that, and I should be much more excited about this. They have said in this announcement that there is like boss rush mode and stuff like that, so there is some more in this one, but I think for me I just wish they just did it as a pack, like you got one and two together. Like, they should have just done it like you'd play number one and then you unlock number two. They're clearly using the same engine. The graphics are pretty much exactly the same. You know, it's just different enemies and environments and stuff like that. I'm a sucker, so I am going to buy it. Let's be honest.
Of course you are.
Of course I am. But we're expecting it in spring of 2025. In this announcement, it says for Xbox. I imagine it's coming for the Switch as well. But
and PlayStation last one did, didn't it?
Yeah, we did. We came out on everything eventually, the first one, but it did come out on Switch first. I don't know how the PlayStation and Xbox ones are compared to the Switch one, but it just felt like the Switch was the obvious choice because of the motion controls. But yeah, we'll see. We'll see. Maybe I just need to replay the first one and see if it's any better now.
Yeah, it does. It looks to me, you know, like a huge fan of the original, absolutely amazing game. And kind of the bad textures and stuff really actually draws me to it. For me, like a remaster would be having that, but having like, more modern effects and stuff like that, but still having it in that old kind of style. Sometimes really high-end glossy kind of remasters don't really work, and we've seen it quite a few things. Let's hope that this one does. I used to love House of the Dead 2. I thought it was great. Just reminds me of cigarette-laden arcades and,
nice.
just like rave music and, yeah, kind of wasting all your money as a kid. just playing that, trying to look cool. Yeah, really, really enjoyed that title. Great music as well. I hope the soundtrack has also been, you know, a bit updated. And
it's some, in like, there in the trailer, and it's a new song, but it's definitely like using samples and elements of the kind of main theme of the first one. It's all right. It's all right. You know, it's not too bad.
I do see you mentioned the trailer there as well. Actually, in the YouTube thumbnail, they've got Nintendo Switch, PlayStation, Xbox, GOG, and Steam logos all on there. Yeah. So by the looks of it, coming to all those platforms again. But for me, I mean, the big sticking point is, and I was looking, so, I mean, you mentioned about playing it with the motion controls on the Switch, which I was thinking if I was to play this, because as far as I know, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, I've not seen any light guns that work with the Xbox Series X. Maybe they're out there.
So, no.
I can't think of any off the top of my head. And to me, these games, they're only really fun with the light guns. I couldn't imagine playing it with a controller.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I need to get one of these Joy-Con light gun things that you can slot in and see what it's like. Because of, yeah, like I say, I don't... The triggers as well on the Joy-Cons are much to be desired. So, yeah, maybe I just need to mix it up again. Try it with maybe one of his cheap plastic guns or something.
Well, apparently the first one, you could play it on the Xbox with a mouse.
Okay.
Which I imagine will be a little bit more reactive than trying to use a controller to move like an on-screen kind of crosshair. And, you know, it's on Steam. It says in GOG as well. I'm not sure whether they're going to make it work like, you know, the Sindon light guns, that kind of thing, which again would be... Yeah. Yeah, that would definitely be, you know, my preferred way of playing it. But yeah, it's like, I do remember playing some, you know, do you remember Zombie Apocalypse on the Amiga, Ravi, where you could use a mouse?
Yeah, there was quite a few games on the Amiga where I was forced to use a mouse as well, actually.
Yeah.
One with like gangsters coming out of the window.
Oh, God.
And they kept opening, and it was like a Al Capone style one. I'm sure people will tell me straight away. Yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, like you said, Joe, the first one didn't get great reviews, but obviously, you know, we never write anything off until we've tried it. So I know Joe's going to be a day one purchaser of this. So I'm sure he'll give us your review in the spring. So if you want to check out the trailer, I'll put that in this week's show notes as well. Now, we also love talking about discovered long-lost prototypes when they've been brought back to life. You know, we're all big supporters of game preservation. So I do think it's interesting when prototypes from companies as big as Atari, and we're talking about Atari's coin-op division, who obviously in the early 80s were, you know, they kind of ruled the world, didn't they? Not only in the arcade, but in the home as well. And this is a really interesting find. Now, this was posted on the fantastic Atari Age forum on Friday, so this is quite a new story, that a game has been found on a VAX backup tape, which I imagine is one of those kind of, which like
found it and managed to actually get it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this was, I imagine, from Atari's coin-op division's in-house mainframe, one of those big kind of reel-to-reel backups from 1983. And someone has managed to get their hands on this and found a previously unheard of game that now is available to play to everybody. This is actually a backup tape that belonged to a guy called Mike Albaugh, who worked at Atari for many years. He started there in 1977. So, you know, right really at the start of obviously the home division and not long after Pong and that came out. And he was there until the year 2000 through all of their different iterations. And there are a couple of interviews with him online. He sounds like a really interesting guy, and I think definitely a someone I'd love to have on the podcast. If we do, maybe we could ask him more about this. I'll definitely be reaching out. But they're not sure where this came from, because it was actually on a backup from Mike's mainframe that he worked on, but they're not sure whether it's something he was playing around with in his spare time, because even though this is from Atari's coin-op division, it's a game for the Atari 2600. So they're wondering if maybe Mike was just kind of doing some 2600 programming in the evenings to learn the hardware. Or another explanation might be that someone made this and sent it into Atari for a bit of feedback, but it never made it to market. So it's really all speculation at this stage, but it looks like the game is finished. And this was a guy called that Dutchman 2000 who's posted this. And actually, you can download the ROM to play on your own system of our emulation. Now, the build date for this is the 22nd of December 1983, and obviously we kind of know what was happening in the North American video game market, particularly Atari, around that stage. That's kind of the start of the giant video game crash, wasn't it? So maybe that affected the release of this game. It's out there now.
It's quite interesting, and it's quite like nice, like graphically, and runs quite well as well, especially for the 2600.
It's very smooth.
Yeah, and there's little like gradients on the fish. Obviously tropical fish.
Yeah.
Quite like it.
I'm trying to work out if it's the first ever iteration of Feeding Frenzy. I could be completely wrong. I don't know the history. Do you know what Feeding Frenzy is? Like, it's essentially this game where you play as the little fish and you have to eat fish that are smaller than you and you grow bigger.
It's on the PC, right? Wasn't it?
Yeah, it's been on everything that has. I used to play it at school when I was in secondary school. But in this game, fish, you can eat certain enemies which will make you bigger. So I was looking at the chart earlier on AtariProcess.com. And if you eat, so you can eat little worms that can't hurt you that give you like 50 points, but then you get giant worms if you leave the little worms. It's quite in depth, actually, for a little fish game that we don't really know where it came
from. Fish enemies get bigger as well.
Yeah, the fish enemies get bigger, but it's like an egg will appear on the screen. If you don't eat an egg quick enough, then like a different fish will hatch out of it. If you eat a power ball, then you can shoot a squid. And then when you've killed the squid, a bigger fish will appear on the screen. Then when you eat the bigger fish, you'll become bigger. Like, you know, that actually sounds quite in depth for me.
Yeah, sounds quite fun as well.
Yeah. And like I say, I don't know, that could be completely wrong, but I just feel like this is definitely like the foundations for a silly, well-known game that's been around for like a few decades now. And I'm like, I wonder if this is the first kind of like similar version of that game. I could be completely wrong. Might be some arcade game out there that everybody's screaming at me right now. But usually when I see these Atari 2600 prototypes, I'm like, yeah, it's cool. But I actually really like the look of this one. It looks like I would enjoy it, you know, figuring out the mechanics of it and stuff.
And there is 99 different levels as well. Oh, wow. Waves of different fish, which it's quite a lot for an Atari 2600 game. There's even sound, which changes every single level. There's music, a demo mode of it as well. So, yeah, I think in terms of, you know, it looks like, obviously you can download the ROM and try it out for yourself, but it looks like it's a fully complete game that for some reason just kind of never made it out onto market. Like I said, maybe it was just bad timing, you know, the video game crash kind of happening around then. But I think it's very cool that it's been discovered, and hopefully we will learn a bit more about this story. So I think the fact that they've just discovered this on some kind of long lost kind of, you know, tape that's been gathering dust in someone's attic for like 40 years and now is available for anyone to play for free, which I think is very cool. So if you want to read more about that and also download the ROM, I'll link that up. And of course, all the rest of the stories, I do that every week. You don't have to Google around. I save you the job. I put them all in the show notes, or you can head straight through to our website at theretrohour.com and click straight through. Okay, then, before we chat to this week's special guest, Eugene Sendulenko, getting the story of ScumVM. Fascinating if you love your adventure games. Before we do, let's just take a quick moment to give a massive thank you to our sponsor. It is our amazing friends at... You know the sound by now. It's our mates at Shopify. And that, of course, is the sound of making another sale. And the sound that we hear every time we sell another one of our books through our website, which there are still some available. If you want to get your hands on a Retro Hour book, head to our website, theretrohour.com, because actually our store on there is powered by Shopify. And you set that up in like your lunch break, Ravi.
Yeah, well, it's really easy to do. You know, designing on Shopify, creating a store. I didn't need to do any coding or anything like that. Just put it together, and then you can choose your regions that you post to. It does shipping and all of that, and it's really simple as well because it's got good customer support. I really love it. You know, you can sell it on your desktop. You don't even need one. You can do it on your mobile phone as well and set up on that. And I just think it's an absolutely great system. It's got point of sale as well, so you can actually have your mobile phone and then, you know, sell when you're on a stand, which is really important as well. If you're out at shows, if you're doing trading, you know, a lot of people that we know sell retro games, and it's a great thing for that as well, because you can get your whole inventory on there have a list of stuff and then just quickly select it and then make that sale.
Takes all the headache out of doing it, doesn't it? Even in terms of like selling online as well, works out all the postage for you. You can even print labels from it, can't you, directly?
Yeah.
Rather than writing them out
and
yourself.
You can get a full like point of sale unit like a shop as well. You know, so you can actually have one in your store, which is amazing.
Yeah, so Shopify is the all-in-one commerce platform to start, run, and grow your business. So maybe this year, maybe you've got a bit of a side hustle going on, you want to get serious about it in 2025. Maybe you're thinking of becoming your own boss this year. A lot of people are doing that right now. Shopify is there to help you every step of the way and is revolutionizing millions of businesses all around the world right now. It even gets you selling across your social media marketplaces too, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and full of industry-leading tools ready to ignite your growth every step of the way. Like Ravi said, no new skills that you need to learn. You don't have to learn design, coding. They take care of it all, and they've got award-winning help and an extensive business course library as well. So it's time to get serious about selling. Why don't you give Shopify a try today? Now, we've got an incredible offer. Honestly, it's a no-brainer. If you sell anything at all, online or in person, you can try Shopify for just £1 a month. Now, use our link. We'll know that we sent you. Helps out the podcast. Shopify.co.uk/retrohour. All lowercase, shopify.co.uk/retrohour. I'll put that in the show notes as well so you can click straight through and get ready to take your business to the next level today and hear a lot more of this. Right then, well, thank you for checking out the news this week. We'll have more for you, of course, on next Friday's podcast. And next, going inside the world of ScumVM with project lead Eugene Sendwalenko. He's coming up next on the Retro Hour podcast.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it is time to welcome on this week's very special guest. And you'll know if you've listened to previous episodes of the podcast what massive fans of adventure games Ravi and I both are, particularly the older LucasArts games. And, you know, they were such formative games in my childhood. And they've actually been made possible to play these classic games on modern systems. I say modern, this is for the last 23 years now, using an incredible tool called ScumVM, which is a set of game engine recreations originally designed to let us play those LucasArts adventure games on modern systems and now expanded to support a massive variety of non-Scum games by different companies like Revolution Software, AdventureSoft, and lots more. So we thought we'd find out a bit more about it with the project lead of ScumVM, Eugene Sendwalenko. How's it going, Eugene?
Hello, everyone. Thank you, Dan, for a nice introduction. And hi, Ravi. I'm really glad to be here with you guys.
Yeah, really appreciate you taking some time out to share some inside stories on ScumVM. Like I said, you know, for someone who grew up playing those games, it's been just revolutionary. And we're talking before we started recording about just how many different platforms and systems it's on, which we'll get into more soon. But I'm interested a bit about your background, Eugene. I mean, where did it all start for you? What was your first gaming experience? What first got you into video games?
I vaguely remember, but I can tell you that besides the arcade games, I actually started off playing adventure games, and this is probably why got me lured into the project themselves. But the irony is that I didn't play LucasArts specific ones. I was playing Sierra Adventures, and I was playing also Goblins from the Cocktail Vision French studio. And also later, I remember like Neverhood, Broken Swords, so those games. This is which I remember. But probably the earliest ones were arcades, and when I was a kid, I was watching over somebody else's shoulder how they play. They were big novelty in our country, and this is like why I couldn't afford those. So I was just watching. So that's how.
And what home system did you have?
I had none. The first computer which I got, which I owned, was even after my marriage at age of 25.
Right.
Before that, I had access to computers either in the school or university or at my daily job. But I started actually working as a daily job really, really early as 15. I started already making money messing with computers. And I was working with computers since the age of 13, but it was somewhere else always. And I even used to say that I don't buy a computer home because I had made more than enough at my daily job.
You're sick of them by the time you got home, yeah.
Yes.
So what got you interested in computer programming then? Why did you want to do that for a job?
I was really fascinated. I started, looking into math. But then at the age of, I believe, 12 or 18, in my local youth magazines, which about tech, they started to publish the schematics of computers. And it was based on 8080, Intel 8080. I learned assembly. I didn't have a computer, so I started writing programs just in a notebook, like paper notebook. And I started to reverse engineer an existing published ones. And then what was happening is that when I was talking much to a friend of our family who was one of the professors in the local university, he, seeing my interest, just arranged that I'm being just a schoolboy, had access to university lab. And my first computers were actually big iron. It was a System 360 analog. It was PDP-11. Those the machines which where I learned programming. And I still remember this gentleman who was there was the role of computer operator. So the guy who was running, sitting on the front of machine, and then the machines had many terminals. And he saw that I put the machine on its knees because I was compiling. And he asked me, hey, boy, like, what do you do? What programming languages do you know? And I thought, I know BASIC, which I learned from the paper, and I know C. That was my second language. And this is how it started. And it was the year 1990. So, like, imagine, how old is this? 35 years ago, mamma mia.
It's insane, though, that you basically got your start on mainframes then. It's, you know, quite a lot more advanced than those of us who were at home with like Commodore 64s or something. Yeah.
Indeed. In my first paid daily job was on the Unix machines. So this is why I learned certain things in a proper way, I would say. I didn't have to have like big bad habits coming from solely from BASIC programming.
Let's talk about ScumVMs. I mean, that project started in 2001. When did you first become aware of ScumVM?
I joined, if I remember correctly, like early October 2003. So the project was 2 years old by this time. I was a user of FreeBSD, even on my desktop machine, call me crazy. But this is what I was using because this was coming from my first proper daily job, as I mentioned, based on Unixes. And as you can imagine, the gaming was very limited. And I was just in a local shop and I saw this CD with Full Throttle. And it was Russian localization of Full Throttle. And I bought it and I decided to take a look how to run it. I Googled, I remember maybe Alta Vista, what was that at the time, Lycos.
Yeah.
I found out about ScumVM. I was able to get it. I started to compile it. I think it was very simple thing for FreeBSD to make it compilable. And then I was able to launch the Full Throttle, which crashed immediately. Like really immediately on a startup. Why? Because there was a problem with the with changed font, and I fixed that because I was a software developer. And then I started playing, and then 15 minutes into gameplay, there was a pop-up. Hey, there is this bike fight scene which is not implemented, but we pretended that it was there, and here is the as a result of it, you're getting jumping ramp. Here is the ramp. And I was like, why? The game is not complete. And then I reached out to the how to reach out to developers. They were on IRC, Internet Relay Chat. And this is how I started. I offered my services, I would say, to complete the engine. It was Scum-based, Scum version 7 for the full throttle. And I started working on this subsystem, which is called Insane. And of course, I didn't know why. Later, I figured it out because it was insane. Apparently, they were using some kind of code generators or whatever. One story short, it took me about 3 or 4 months of implementing of every night working on this thing. And I produced more than 10,000 lines of code because it's very, very complex. Because what is this? Basically, it is the actors on top of a video. And then it used cues in order to make this interactive and such this way implementing those bike fights. And this way,
It was a very tough game, that was, because it had these animated scenes and a very movie-like kind of feel in between the point and click. Yeah.
And this is how I got into the project. Then very shortly, I followed up with the Goblins engine. This is what I wanted, which I like to play. And then it has been, 22 years now.
Well, let's talk a bit about the technology behind ScumVM. So I often see people incorrectly refer to it as an emulator, but it's not an emulator, is it? How does it work?
Yes, it is not an emulator. It's a correct statement. Emulator normally emulates some system on a low level. Like there is a CPU, there is a graphics subsystem and whatever. And then it's just virtual implementation of a physical object of a computer. We don't do it. What you can call the easiest thing to comprehend what ScumVM is, it's a series of source ports. So now people talking about source ports, because this is actually what it is. In many, many cases, we actually working from the original source code. So we are taking original source code, all the logic of the engine, and we just make it portable. This is our goal of the project. As a result, it's portable. It will live forever after this, as long as we support it. And the architecture of ScumVM is written in a such way that a new port to a new system requires approximately 1 or 2 weeks of the evenings for a developer familiar with the target system. For instance, when Switch was released and once the SDK was published for Homebrew, ScumVM was ported within 3 or 4 weeks after that. We right away have it. And if something in the future will be released, and as soon as there is an available software development kit for this, it will be very easy things to port. We even had a port for TVs. There are some TVs which have, now we have TVs with Android, but even before that, there was a Tizen system which was Samsung based. We even had those. So you have built-in computer and you can run in it. ScumVM even was running on some of the airlines infotainment system.
Wow.
Because I remember one of the developers, he had some connections, and this is how we was pushing it. And they were, by the way, running Humongous Entertainment games. It can run anywhere, which you can run. The most impressive port, which I know, was on the original Nintendo 64. So you can flash a cartridge and then run it. And then imagine running full throttle on that thing. Wow.
Yeah, that's insane.
Well, in 2008, you became the project lead for ScumVM. When this transition came about, how did you kind of prepare to take on that role and what changed?
First of all, I became a co-lead because we were two for a long while with Max Horn, also known as Finglefin. The thing is that when I joined the project, there were two co-leads. There was also Joe, it was Ender, and Ender unfortunately lost interest in the project. But I got more and more involvement. And then Ender lost interest to a point that he had no time for doing a release. And I stepped in because I had free time and interest, I made a release. If I remember, it was 0.70 or something like this. And then I got into it. And like one or two releases later, I was invited by Max Hornfingelfin to join him. And this is how we became two co-leads. It was for a little while. After that, Max graduated and he left the project. And I was alone for several years. And it was quite difficult because the project is quite big. We have active core of maybe like about 50 developers. And routinely every year, it's about 150 developers which come and go. And this is like why, especially after merging with Residual VM, I increased the number of co-leads of helping me, and there is now currently officially four of us. But yeah, so this is how it works.
Early on, I did read that ScumVM faced a cease and desist from LucasArts. I mean, do you know much about that situation and kind of why that happened? And what's your relationship like with like the former team of LucasArts today?
It was actually not once, but it was twice from LucasArts, and there was additional attempt from other IP right owners. All of them were unsuccessful because ScumVM is completely legal. However, the very thing that ScumVM is completely legal is our conscious and very careful and deliberate choice, because probably heard, because people don't like it, we have very strict no piracy policy. Meaning, if you mention on our public media, I mean, we are not the police, what you do is up to you, but if you come to our platform of any of our online platforms and you publicly admit that you downloaded like disk image from somewhere or from torrent or whatever, and you're trying to run with it and having troubles, we will immediately tell you that we provide you no support. And if you insist, you ban. But this is because we became much softer. Before that, we would ban you immediately on the spot. But why is that? Because thanks to this, it is known to IP right owners. And it led to a situation that a number of them even collaborated with us because they were entrusting us their IP rights, intellectual property. They were giving us the source code. Several games were freeware. One of the super last examples of such a nice and fruitful collaboration was with this Zoom platform. It's not the Zoom which is used for the video conference. It's Zoom-platform. Yeah. It's an online shop similar to Good Old Games or Steam, GOG. And they acquired rights for Spacebar from Steven Meretsky. And we had a collaboration with them that they gave us the source code, and we created the port of it as an engine on ScumVM. And now with the latest release of ScumVM, which was at the end of December, we have the official support of the game. And now the Steam release was switched from original executable with very low compatibility. It doesn't run well on Windows 10 or Windows 11 with ScumVM, which runs there perfectly. But besides that, of course, you can run on all the 30 platforms which are supported by ScumVM. So this is like why now, because we are so strict. But of course, why we are doing various so strict about piracy, because we don't want to have more cease and desist letters. I want to sleep well, and I want for everyone in the team to sleep well. Most of us are in Europe, just coincidence, but some of us are also in the United States and in other parts of the globe. We don't want any troubles because we are a bunch of volunteers doing it for fun. And if your fun brings you like fine or prison or whatever, it's not fun anymore, no?
Yeah, of course.
And I think that's great that, you know, some stuff was kind of becoming freeware and people were giving you source code. I was wondering if you had any developers where something was particularly hard and, you know, you had to get in contact with them or say, like, how did you do this? And maybe they gave you a little hand.
We actually do it routinely. So first of all, in order to have a game added to ScumVM, since I mentioned to you it's a source port, it takes very, very significant amount of time. It's like from months to years. So that means that number one thing which is required is a developer who is stubborn enough to work on something. And as a result, this is very often connected with nostalgia. Like, here is the game from my childhood. I would like to relive it again. And one of the things which we do, we're trying to find the contacts of the original developers. And we then try to email them and ask, hey, do you happen to have source code? Do you happen to have maybe the rights of having it? And it led to number of engines which when we got original source code. For instance, by this time, we already have source code for the Humongous Entertainment, for the Scum engine. We have source code for Broken Sword games, for the Simon the Sorcerer, and for a number of other engines. One of the surprising things that out of blue, we got just one day got an email from the original author of this game, which is called DreamWeb. And he thought, hey, the IP right owners, IP rights, intellectual property rights have returned to me. I own the game. Here is the source code. Please do whatever you want with it. And we clarify, do you mean that the game also free? Yes, it's free. So now it's freeware and the engine is in ScumVM. And this is like how it happens. Like, that's awesome. So nice.
Yeah, yes. I mean, I remember playing DreamWeb on the Amiga back in the day. That was like a cyberpunk kind of top-down adventure, wasn't it? Really good game.
Yeah, indeed.
Well, you mentioned there about, you know, the fact that, you know, developers approach you and say, you know, can you support this? And we mentioned at the start about the fact that ScumVM originally was for the LucasArts adventure games, and then you mentioned like Revolution Software, AdventureSoft. How many different engines are supported by ScumVM now?
We have currently 112.
That's crazy.
And yeah, it's super crazy. But there is a common, also another common misconception. First one is a ScumVM is not an emulator. The first non-Scum engine was, so the project started around August 2001. And the first non-Scum engine was added in October 2001.
Right at the start.
Like
then.
Two months of the project. It was the engine for the Simon the Sorcerer. This just happened that the name was kind of catches ScumVM, and we decided not to change it to Adventure VM or whatever. And this is how it's there. We even have a page on our wiki, which is called ScumVM name. You can go and look at it. And we, out of joke, made like 20 different funny, we try to be funny, the abbreviation, what ScumVM is, in order to justify sticking with the name.
Right. Well, I know one big milestone that I remember reading about, probably going back about 5-6 years now, was when Blade Runner by Westwood Studios was supported by ScumVM. And I remember reading that was quite a big milestone for the project. I mean, what kind of challenges did that game present then, and how did you overcome them?
So far, it is the most complex and the biggest engine which we added, I mean, by the time of development and effort which was required. Because it took us, believe it or not, 8 years. 8 years to develop it. I was playing the game, and I was really fascinated by it, and of course I watched the movie. But there is a problem with this engine, is that it doesn't have any scripting language. All of the logic of the whole game was written in C originally. And as a result, there is logic of every location and of every character. So when you take a look at the game, you will see that it was consisting on one executable of quite big size, I believe like 1.5 megabytes or something like this. But on top of that, 98 DLLs. each DLL was representing just specific location or specific, as they were calling, AI for a person. And if you remember, the game itself is very complex because it is it has so many branches, code branches, depending on the mode, depending on your history, depending on the time. And imagine now that every this condition has to be just reverse engineered because the source code is lost forever and rewritten and debugged. So this is like why it took so much time for us. But it was extremely nice achievement. We loved it. And I still love the game and recommend it to anyone else.
Well, I think adding support as well for Macrom Media Director was pretty interesting as well. I kind of love those, that period of games, and also, you know, some of the flash stuff that they had back then. You know, that technology, it's like an area that's kind of disappeared from my mind, but it's great to see it kind of come back. What motivated the team to tackle that one?
Coincidentally or not, but this is my pet project.
Right.
Before that, we had Alisa Milburn, which is known Fuzzy. She was at the beginning of the project, but already like over 15 years ago. And she was one who was pushing very much, and she was in love with this. And I did understand, because I was not familiar with this technology like at all. I knew about Micromedia Flash, but Micromedia Director I even didn't hear about. But then I started to take a look into it, and I got in love with this thing. And this is like why I started. First of all, I took the original Python code from Alisa, and we started to put it into Google Summer of Code project. So it was we started to add in Director 2 support, which was her code about. And then later it just snowballed. Currently, we are working on Director 5. We covered Director 2, 3, 4, and 5. But of course, starting from Director 4, there are a lot of bespoke code, which is called extras. So those individual requires reverse engineering. And what makes it even more fascinating is that I have direct contact with John Henry Thompson, who is the inventor of the Lingo language for the Director. And we had a number of Skype calls with him, and he is still like teaching in New York in some universities. And he was giving us some history, some interesting stuff. And I would like to share one little story. Is that he tells that, hey, you know, Eugene, there is an old friend of mine, and he has this old project. When he was young, he was a musician, and he had this thing called Media Band. And he created on Director this media Media Band interactive CD. But unfortunately, it doesn't run on anything. Now he has his grandchildren, and he would like to meet with you, and because he's so like anticipating the support, so he can show it to his grandchildren, his creation of his youth, you know. They say, okay, yeah, sounds fine, yeah. Like, and he says that this is Mark Hunter, and okay, Mark Hunter, whoever. But then suddenly I was just Googling it. I see my Mark Hunter, this is CEO of Micromedia.
Yeah.
I never knew. And we met with Mark also. And it is so like those giant, you know, giants on shoulders of those, I believe, a lot of multimedia stays, because Micromedia Director is so clever system, so innovative at the time. And it's so pitiful to me that Adobe just basically turn it first into bloatware and they killed it. But that's the thing, and we love it. And there are several projects related to this, because even according to the like very lightweight counts, there are at least 14,000 titles built on Micromedia Director.
It's crazy. Yeah. I was just talking to Dan, and me and Dan actually were taught it at college and school, which is just really mad. And it's interesting to see that kind of period of, you know, interactive CD-ROM, but also stuff like Encarta as well, which is supported, which I find that's amazing that you can play Inkata on ScumVM.
Exactly, yes. That's our cover magazines, all of them were contained director.
Yes, yeah, lots of
you remember those magazines. When magazines had cover CDs, right? Yeah.
Yeah, before I had the internet at home, that would last me a month, a magazine cover CD, yeah. Well, interesting. I mean, you know, talking about that time, obviously, you know, it was around the time when Flash was taken off. I'm ready to kind of touch on Flash games as well. Any plans to kind of extend that in ScumVM and cover, like, you know, just general Flash games?
We are not talking about this this moment. Right. However, it was a couple of times on the plate, but there are several open source projects directed specifically to Flash. Hmm. At this moment, we are concentrated on Directory primarily. Maybe we will take a look into Shockwave, because Shockwave is the same director just in disguise. And Shockwave games, it's like 200,000. They're collected, so many.
There was a lot of online ones as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Shockwave
is director put online. This is the thing. It started from Shockwave 1.0 is actually director 4.0 internally. So we can already run some of the Shockwave titles. So Flash is not on our radar at this moment just because of the limited resources. Maybe somebody. Also, another thing which I would like to personally would like to like look into maybe later is HyperCard. Mm. That would be also nice, especially imagine if you would be able to run the first Myst, which was HyperCard, or this Manhole, which was also very popular and breakthrough HyperCard game.
Now, obviously, ScumVM not only recreates game experiences, but I know sometimes ScumVM can actually enhance some of the older games as well. So where does that kind of line get drawn, you know, introducing kind of improvements versus sticking completely to the original design?
We try to, first of all, as a priority, recreate the original experience. But then we always try to work on a very simple things like, for instance, increasing number of the save slots, which goes as granted. Or we have the filters for increasing graphics. Now it's shader based. You can have a CRT shader. You can consider this also as enhancement. And then we started to work on like what else we can do. For instance, on Scum Engine, even Scum games, there are some subtle difference between different versions on different platforms, or maybe there is a difference between floppy version and CD version because we see they somehow like removed scene or added scene. So we added to re-add those, but then we kind of dislike it by ourselves. And as a result, we recently, Eric Torbjörn, recently developed a small system. You can see it in the latest release, where you can have hierarchy of fixes, and you can say, hey, I would like to have visual only fixes apply, or I would like to have a game logic applied, or you just untick everything and then you get original experience. However, there is also one particular class of bugs which we fix unconditionally. Those are crashing bugs or dead end bugs, especially for the Sierra Creative Interpreter games, SCI. We have the whole small subsystem of fixing the original script bugs. Because you probably heard that Sierra games were very, very buggy. Their quality control was much worse than LucasArts at the time. But they had no trouble with releasing very often patches. So what we do, we very often incorporate those patches into earlier versions or even fix those things which were never discovered or never fixed in the original. So this is what we try to do. And beyond that, there is only one game which has more substantial enhancement than the original. And coincidentally, this is Blade Runner. Mm. Just because we have one particular person who I think speaks not English or Spanish, because I think this person is Spanish, but Blade Runner-ish.
right? Lives and breathes the game, yeah?
Exactly. And they have their own, how to say, a version, which we call Blade Runner Enhanced. Because what happened, if you take a look internally into resources, there are many, many scenes which were never completed, which were removed from the game, but the resources are still present. Mm. There are whole lines of dialogues of everything. And this person just created like a new, even new branches of the game, completely new one, which were not present in the original. And you, when you add in Blade Runner to ScumVM, you are offered with two options, either added as original or added as enhanced edition. However, we haven't incorporated all of his changes yet. They exist in a ScumVM fork, but I think eventually we will do it. But this is the only game, once again, the reason for that is very simple, because there is one specific person who is very much interested into putting effort, blood and sweat into this particular project. I cannot force anyone. We are a bunch of volunteers and living in different parts of the world. We are not even sitting in the same office. I cannot put the pressure of anyone. So whenever somebody wants to work on it, they are more than welcome. And when somebody comes to us and say, hey, we would like to do this enhancement. However, there is one particular thing which we say no. And this is connected again with piracy. Recently, there were several projects which are taking original graphics and enhance it with AI or with hand-drawn things. The problem is that this is a very slippery road of the intellectual property property and copyright violations. Because those things, characters of the game, graphics, are very often, they are protected by copyright.
Yeah.
And if you start redistributing basically the whole games, all the backdrops, all of the characters, and in a higher resolution without consent of the original authors, you could be in the copyright infringement. So we say no to those. However, there were one particular case when there were negotiations with the original right owners on enhancing one particular game. But unfortunately, the person kind of disappeared from my radar. And I don't know what was happening, what ended up. We don't have it. But if that would be the case, then we would welcome this. And of course, let me just advertise a little bit, James Woodcock. This is very respectable gentleman from Britain who is a fan of Yamaha synthesizers. Mm. And he is a big fan of Simon, the Sorcerer game, and other games. And what he did with official approvals, he has his soundtracks, which were original MIDI soundtracks. He played on highly sophisticated Yamaha synthesizers. And you can go and you can download it or purchase those tracks. And those work with ScumVM because they are officially endorsed by and supported by original authors.
I think like one thing about ScumVM is the kind of variety of different platforms that it supports, but also like the variety of hardware as well. Like, you know, seeing versions of like the MT32 soundtrack for certain titles. It must be a nightmare with all those different kind of sound cards and, you know, implementing those titles and also trying to get every single port kind of a game out there.
Absolutely. And the downside of it is that modern users are a bit of spoiled in a sense that they consider everything or many things as granted and they demand flawless things. And the like negative side of it, they are too lazy to report bugs. Especially if you're talking about Android and iOS users, they prefer to just give you one star review without any details because some of the things doesn't work out of, 3,000 games which are supported, one maybe some obscure title. We actually need those reports. if you listen to the podcast, and if you ever saw any problem or inconsistency on Scambium, please, please reach out to the team and tell us. We would like to solve it, because I have no time for playing the games. I have even less time of replaying them over and over. This is what, if you would like to say thanks to the project, one of the best ways is to come back with the bug report, or even just confirm that, yes, some particular game is completable, it's fine, it's flawless at this moment, it works. That would help us to enhance it and improve it for the future users, for the future generations even.
And I guess that accuracy is really important as well. You know, having something on a piece of hardware that no one's ever used, and then they're able to now actually experience it. And sometimes that hardware is pretty expensive. It's a really nice thing. And I personally have gone on like some of the really low-end titles and tried the low-end versions of those, and then tried the really high-end expensive setups. And it's a just yes. great way of exploring games.
Absolutely. And the goal of our project is to have pixel perfect thing. So we are really care if you find that maybe some subtitles in some game or some characters is 2 pixels off from the original. We do care. We would like to fix it.
And just, you know, Ravi kind of touched on the amount of platforms that ScumVM is available for. And I mean, I'm looking through your website in the download section, you know, get all sorts on here. Haiku, which is a modern open source kind of spin-off of BOS. You've got Amiga OS, you know, Morph OS, Risk OS as well. You know, there are ports on so many different systems. And I think that's awesome. So, I mean, I remember first, I think, experiencing ScumVM probably on my Amiga. So I was still using an Amiga 1200 up until, like, you know, the early 2000s. And being able to run The Curse of Monkey Island on my Amiga when it was never officially released on that platform, you know, that kind of really opens up all these platforms to huge game libraries as well. I mean, is that kind of one of the aims of it then, just to make these titles available to as many people and as many platforms as possible?
Yes, this is exactly the aim of the platform. ScumVM is all about multi-platform and giving and getting access. I remember in about 2009, maybe 2010, on the Google Summer of Code Mentor Summit, we were approached by Haiku guys. And they, because we were wearing a t-shirt, we are not on video, I'm also now wearing ScumVM t-shirt, and they recognized us and they say, "Hey guys, we are so thankful you to give to, because ScumVM is one of the most complex programs which is ported for Haiku, and we use it as a like stress test for our system, for our new releases and everything." It was nice to hear from that. I believe that besides OpenBSD, ScumVM is one of the most portable, complex pieces of software, complex meaning with graphics, with sound, because, of course, you can say talk about Zlib, which runs everywhere as a compression library, but something more complex, ScumVM is one of the most ported system. We are pretty proud by it. And for me personally, it's a little bit sad, I would say, to see that the platform are dying, and you can see how they dying. We have a kind of cemetery on bottom part of our downloads page when we have older ports which are not updated anymore, because they basically dead. The hardware is aging, hardware is dying.
Yeah, but see the Ouya port there that hasn't been updated since 2016. But
oh yeah, I created that port. Right, yes, that was a little funny system. And another impressive port was the original one from the Palm OS. Palm OS was so tiny system and so restrictive, so it was kind of a trick to have things working there. So yeah, ScumVM can run everywhere. Maybe the Doom can run everywhere, but ScumVM could be the second one.
Yes. We'll see it running on a toaster one day, like Doom, yeah. I mean, you know, one thing that I love about ScumVM is you support the, you know, the full motion video games as well, you know, having full FMV in there as well. Was that much of a challenge when that was introduced?
It came actually absolutely natural, because we have videos, video codecs for a long, long while. And those things actually, internally, they are pretty simple, much simpler than the typical adventure game. It was, of course, fancy by the technology or in the past, 20 years ago, I've seen full motion video. On the modern things, you can run it on any potato. But from this perspective, the bigger challenge was, I would say, conceptual, because ScumVM for a long, long while was strictly point-and-click adventures. Now we became a little bit more relaxed, so we can accept almost anything which has a story and interactivity with it. Because one of the engines which about to join us is how it's called, Railgun. Yes, Railgun Games. This is American, you know, American something. I forgot. They're very, very popular games.
American laser games?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Those games.
And Mad Dog McCree and, yeah, those classics.
Precisely, yeah. Exactly. Those games, which are like, you can hardly tell that they are point-and-click adventures, but, well, you're point and you click.
Yeah. Yeah. Loose definition. Yeah.
Yes.
And then I guess you have to have Laserdisc support in for those as well.
Well, I don't know about that because there are actually, if you're talking about Dragon's Lair, there is another engine which is almost there, but it works with Amiga version of the game. Yeah. We have developer already about to join us and bring in this engine with him.
Well, here's a question. I mean, you kind of touched briefly before about, you know, AI and people using that. I mean, do you see any potential for AI to assist in the reverse engineering process or any other areas of ScumVM?
No. The biggest problem with them, at least with the modern AI, is that it does not know what is true, what is not. So whatever ChatGPT tells you, it will tell you nonsense with exactly same confidence as it was truth.
Hallucinations.
This is like a hallucinating parrots. Say parrots because they just repeat by keywords, more complex now, but still as a bird, and then hallucinating, coming up with things which are not there. The problem with auto-generated code is that since you didn't write it, you will spend a lot of time on bug fixing, sometimes even much more. And whatever we were trying so far, it has very, very subtle little bugs, which difficult to catch with your eye, but they affect the logic. If you're talking about, ScumVM is 4.7 million lines of code, right? Mm. We cannot take 200 lines of example and say, hey, it works for us. No. But of course, I appreciate that AI is used these days as an assistant tool, for instance, for auto-completion, more smart auto-complete. In many of us using Microsoft Visual source code, this is the IDE, and it has built-in auto-completion now based on AI. That's good as an assistive. But writing full code, I don't think so. If you want to do this, what would be the advantage? Because then just run it on emulator.
Yeah.
Run it on a DOSBox or some like console emulator. Then you will for sure get the thing. Because imagine if we would use this for Blade Runner and imagine it was capable, it would produce 100,000 lines of code. How to find bugs in that soup of code?
Yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah. I think ScumVM's definitely helped with the, the kind of rise in popularity of point-and-click adventures again. And it's cool to see stuff coming out. Great to see stuff like Thimbleweed Park as well coming out. Do you think we're going to see more new point-and-click adventures kind of supported as well?
Yes, we do. And actually, I'm so super glad, for instance, that these days, Pierre Guillot, the original author of the Goblins games, is back to the game. Last year, he released Goblins 5. Now he's working on Goblins 6. It's, by the way, you can support him on Patreon, right?
Mm.
And people do, especially like in Germany, they do it. And I can tell you, yes, you are right, because, for instance, I have a hard facts, only like kind of rumors, because one of our developers is working for Revolution Software. But we actually helped Revolution Software to come back with Broken Sword 3, 4, 5, because it was very good strategic decision of them to hand us the source code of Broken Sword 1 and 2 and Beneath a Steel Sky. And as a result, we added those, and they saw humongous interest among the gaming population. And this is like they risked, because they are a small studio, on doing it, and they're doing it now, as I heard, pretty well financially, just because people have this interest. And of course, they were using ScumVM in some of the re-releases of the Broken Sword 1 and 2. So it's all like very, very nice and merry, I would say. And yeah, same thing, we were collaborating with Sian on 25th anniversary of Myst. Maybe you heard about this project. They had some even physical props with this. And ScumVM is there.
I think that's awesome, because it's definitely sparked an interest. And then to hear people are kind of, you know, taking more risks and getting into that area. And it's just that accessibility of, you know, people being able to get on stuff and play different libraries. I've certainly played a lot of stuff that I've never been able to play before.
Mm-hmm.
100%. Well, Eugene, it's been incredible to hear some inside stories of you and the team at ScumVM and some of the history there as well. And yeah, as Ravi said, I think, you know, just in terms of game preservation and making these titles available, you know, you and the team are doing an incredible job. So thanks so much for coming on and being our guest, and keep up the good work.
Thank you very much, Dan. Thank you, Ravi. And thank you for your great questions. I enjoyed the show.
Into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.